Hotel history is created for adult audiences. Content may not be suitable for all listeners. Discretion is advised. You're listening to Hotel History. We take you with us through the sordid history and scandals of some of the world's most famous and infamous hotels. I'm Dieta.
And I'm Yael. Let's get started.
Welcome, comrade.
Welcome, comrade. What, do they just like salute each other?
I don't know.
We don't know the communist ways.
No.
So this is our book club episode where we're discussing the book A Gentleman in Moscow by Amor Towles. It became a pretty well-known
book.
Yeah,
it was a bestseller.
And they also made a show on Peacock? Paramount?
Paramount. Showtime.
Showtime.
Yeah.
It's a really good show and it's a really good book. There's slight differences. And It's about this character who happens to be a prisoner in the Hotel Metropole in Moscow.
I like that you described that. How does anyone happen to be
That's the whole thing. Actually, the whole story. It's fictional. You got to read the book. No, we're going to discuss it, but it is a real hotel in Moscow, the Hotel Metropole, and we're going to discuss the history of that as well. They did a really good job at recreating the hotel on the show.
And yeah, I looked up. They filmed it in places around the UK.
Yeah, and they didn't go to Russia.
No, they did not.
That was not a good time.
That was not a good time.
Is there ever a good time? Mm.
Yeah. But the author actually did stay in the hotel for, I think, a couple of weeks while he was writing the book to get a feel for it.
Oh, okay.
I watched on his website, there's a link to a video of a talk that he gave somewhere kind of discussing the history of the hotel and his experience writing the novel. It was really, really good. So definitely check that out as well.
I wish in a different world, at a different time, we could go there, maybe one day, I don't know, when things settle down. But this hotel has seen some shit.
Yeah.
It is a very historical hotel.
Well, you know, we always talk about the political intrigue and things that happen in hotels. Usually it's going to, unless it's a Washington, D.C. hotel, which then it's just constant.
Yeah.
But otherwise, it usually like centers around World War II or something like that when a lot of stuff goes down in hotels like that. But with this one, we've never had a hotel that we've talked about that was so central to a whole revolution going on around it. It was really right in the center of things.
Yeah, it's also right across the street from the Kremlin.
Yeah, which is probably why it was right in the center of things.
The fact that it's lasted and it wasn't destroyed during the
very
revolution.
Impressive.
Yeah. So the hotel was built between 1899 and 1905, correct?
Yes.
That's the time. So do we know exactly the year it opened?
Yeah, 1905.
1905. Oh, so it was being built between those years.
Yeah.
It was built in the Art Nouveau style. I love Art Nouveau.
Yeah.
It's very unique. Mm-hmm. You see that in the hotel. It just like, okay, I feel like every hotel, if you want to stand out, you have to have a public space where everyone can go and have a ceiling that's stained glass, or a mezzanine, or something. Like, you gotta make it worthwhile to look up. Am I right?
No? Absolutely.
They have like a whole stained glass ceiling in the dining room, and I think the ballroom.
In the dining room. It's in the I think in the piazza area of the dining room. I can't remember exactly, but it's basically the whole ceiling is one huge stained glass piece, and it's beautiful, and I'm really impressed that it has survived all this time. It's because Conrad Hilton couldn't buy the hotel and cover it with air conditioning.
if the Russians weren't communists, he probably would. You know what it reminds me of? It reminds me of the Palm Court in the Plaza.
Mm-hmm.
Very similar. And it's just luxe. It's really beautiful. I think they've obviously done a lot of work on it since its opening.
Yeah, that's actually one thing that that the author talks about is how this hotel is built during the time of the grand hotels being built. You'll see a ton of similarities between this hotel, the Plaza, the Savoy, different throughout the world, because this was the time of the big grand hotel. You know, the Grand Budapest Hotel by Wes Anderson was based on all of these grand hotels. And they have these similarities. They had a palm court, usually, where people would take tea with a beautiful skylight of some sort. They all had multiple ballrooms. That they had an amazing restaurant that people from all over the city would come to eat at, because usually the restaurant is the best in the city at the hotel.
Yeah, and the customer service is out mm-hmm. of this world. You know, it's luxe. It's they mm-hmm. know, they knew what they were doing. But it makes sense, yeah, because early 1900s, bunch of hotels get developed. And they're in the same style, because Art Nouveau, that was Art Nouveau's time, right? End of the 1800s, mm-hmm. early 1900s.
Yeah, so the person who conceived of the hotel was named Sava Mamontov. I don't know if it's Mamontov, but it looks like Mamontov.
Mamontov?
I don't know. Gudyantov? I don't know.
How would you say it in Russian?
Sava Mamontov.
Sava Mamontov, yeah. I have a Russian friend. Shout out to him. He knows who he is. And he always makes fun. I'm always trying to speak. Well, I'm not trying to speak Russian, but whenever he's like, you should say this word, and I say it, and he's always makes fun of me. Because I grew up listening to the Russian in Brooklyn, which apparently he calls village boy Russian. So there's like the metropolitan like accent, and then there's like the village boy or village girl accent, and I always sound like a village a peasant.
You grew up around like Cockney Russian.
Yeah, I grew up because that's exactly, they all came from a small village, and they you know, they came to the US to escape communism. Mm-hmm. And so that's how I say Russian words. So whenever I say anything, he's like, what are you, a village boy? I'm like, как дела? And he's like, no, you say it smoothly, he's like, как дела? Like, doo-doo. Like, so soft. I'm like, you're he's the most soft-spoken Russian. And everyone I know growing up, when I heard Russian, was like, they're very angry. Even though they were saying the nicest things to me, it could be, they're like, you're a beautiful girl, but how do you say beautiful in Russian?
I don't know.
I feel like you would know. Siri, how do you say beautiful in Russian?
Красивый. I think that's what she's saying.
Okay, so yeah.
They apologies would, if that is not what yeah, she is saying.
I don't
saying.
Know if the word beautiful is красивый or something. Anyways, the point is they'll be like, красивый девочка. And they, you know, they would say nice things. And I'm like, what do you want? I don't know what you're saying.
So anyway, Sava, our friend Sava, he conceived of this idea that he wanted... he loved opera, and so he wanted to build a hotel that went along with the theater so that he could have a hotel with a theater, which I'm just like, sir, you stole that idea from Richard D'Oyly Carte and the Savoy. You did not come up with that idea.
Wait a second. 1898? Yeah, that's right. The Savoy was before.
Mm-hmm. So, but that's what he wanted. The Hotel Metropole is actually located on Theater Square and, you know, right next to a theater. So that was what he envisioned. But he had some other financial issues with his other companies and ended up going to jail for fraud. So the project was taken over by others. And and the Metropole was finally built and opened in 1905. It set the standard for luxury and service, of course, as these grand hotels did. It was the first hotel in Moscow to have hot water and telephones in the rooms. It provided international cuisine in the restaurants, so not just Russian cuisine, even though it did still serve borscht, I'm sure. And it also had an American bar off the lobby, which I recently learned, we learned that the Savoy their bar is called the American Bar, but that was actually a type of bar that was popular in Europe because American bars were known for cocktail culture. And so that when that came over to Europe, they actually just called cocktail lounges American bars. So it was the cocktail bar was a big part of the metropole culture. So within days of its opening, it became the hot place to be for cosmopolitan travelers and also the well-to-do of Moscow.
Before we get into the book, we're going to talk a bit about the Bolshevik Revolution, which is the like kind of the background of the book. It's not the it's not the background. It's the foreground.
Yeah, it's the foreground.
But it's a big part of the book. And if you don't know what the Bolshevik Revolution is, you need to go back to school. And
you're so testy when people don't know what things are. You're like, look it up yourself if you don't know what it is.
No, I'm joking. I mean, listen, we're educating you. Yeah, wow, I'm such a bitch. No, but honestly, no, that's not what people would know it as. They would just know, you know, for a long time, there was the USSR, it was communist, and that's it. They don't know the start of that was the Bolshevik Revolution. So I'm kidding, guys. I'm nice.
She's hungry.
I'm hangry, as my sister said.
So the book starts after the Bolshevik Revolution has already started and the Bolsheviks are in control. But before that happens, you know, there was a bit of a standoff situation happening between the Tsar's soldiers and forces and the Bolsheviks in Moscow. So at this time, St. Petersburg was actually the capital of the country, had been when Peter the Great moved it there. And so the Tsar and his family were in St. Petersburg staying at the Winter Palace. And this is when things kind of come to a head and the Bolsheviks finally just go ahead and basically waylay all of the guards and take over the palace. You know, of course, take off with the royal family. And
so if you want to learn more about that, we suggest you watch the movie Anastasia. It's not historically accurate, but there is the idea that, you know, if you want, certain things stuck out, like the song about St. Petersburg and the royal family and this whole history and how they came and killed her.
You know, they really pick some of the worst possible things as the setting around children's movies.
They like to do that.
They're like, you know, we'll do the absolute massacre of the royal family and we'll do the extinction of the dinosaurs and have fun crying yourselves to sleep, children.
Yeah.
So that's going down in St. Petersburg. It takes about a day for the news to reach Moscow that the revolution has started. And so the Bolsheviks in Moscow, who have had kind of a standoff in Theater Square with the Imperial forces, the Imperial forces basically realized that the Metropole Hotel faced a weak point for the Kremlin. And so they actually took over part of the Metropole and had stationed soldiers and like snipers in the Metropole to try to keep control of the Bolsheviks. And the Bolsheviks set up a barricade in the square. And so there was kind of a standoff that had been happening there for a while. The news reaches them from St. Petersburg and they're like, all right, now's our time. So they, so a battle ensues.
Where's the movie of this?
I know. So there probably is one and we just don't know about it. It's probably I'm sure there's an old movie that covers this. Yeah, there should be
a new movie.
Yeah, there should be. It sounds like this would be very cinematic. So in this battle, nearly every single window in the hotel was shattered. Of course, the Bolsheviks eventually overrun the hotel and the Kremlin and are able to take control of all of the buildings. But during this time, the American journalist John Reed arrives in the city because he was very much a fan of communism and liked to find revolutions about to happen. And he like sniffed out that there was something going down in Russia. And so he shows up and he, goes to the Metropole Hotel to stay there because it's the only hotel he really knows of in the city. And he's like, okay,
he's American. Come on. He wants the good life.
He's like, well, so there's a revolution going on around me. Is there a room in the hotel? And apparently the desk clerk replied, we have some very comfortable rooms if the gentleman does not mind a little fresh air.
Oh, what a professional response. Absolutely. I love that. Making lemonade out of lemons, right?
Exactly. So the Bolsheviks moved the capital back to Moscow, but the city didn't have the infrastructure to house this new government because it hadn't been the capital in hundreds of years. So the Bolsheviks seized the metropole, throw out all of the guests, and renamed it the Second House of the Soviets. And they moved in all of the officials that didn't have a place to stay, and it has started housing all of the departments for this new state. It was in Suite 217 that Yakov Sverdlov, the first chairman of the All-Russia Executive Committee, locked the Constitutional Drafting Committee. He like locked them in the room, vowing that he would not let them out until they had finished drafting the Constitution.
Isn't this what happened with our constitution? They were like locked in, not
they weren't locked in, but they no, it took them a long time to draft it.
It was like the summer.
They had a whole convention. Yeah.
And they were like, we're not leaving here until we figure the shit out. Yeah. I'm like, wow.
Yeah. But it definitely wasn't forced. Yeah. Like in this case.
It's for the greater good.
Yeah. Data. I know. So within a measure of hours, apparently, the committee was able to come up with their constitution that heralded the victory of the proletariat.
So Lenin was there. He must have been the one.
Yeah. So I love that after being locked in the room, they were like, actually, we can come up with this really, really fast, you guys. It shouldn't take us long at all.
Yeah, the state gets everything. And you're fucked. Like,
bada bing, bada boom. So this is where we are in 1922 when a gentleman in Moscow starts. Russia has been in a civil war for the past 5 years, because even though the Bolsheviks eventually won, it did take them a while to overcome all of the people who were loyal to the monarchy.
Yeah, and they destroyed a lot of things in Russia. I didn't realize, actually. It's true, right? What they base it off what was happening, and they were destroying things around that they deemed were
anything that harkened to tradition or the aristocracy luxury that was they just razed it all.
Yeah, and they burned down homes, and they were really destructive and
there's actually
violent.
A cathedral in Moscow that had. They celebrated its 300th anniversary in 1936, I think. So it's been a while since, the Soviet Union has been formed. But to celebrate its 300th anniversary, they burned it to the ground.
Wow. Because they hated religion.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. They said, this is the end of Christianity. This is the death.
They didn't want the competition. That's my theory about communism and religion. Everyone's like, but communism isn't religious. And I'm like, yes, it is. It was their religion was Karl Marx and his
teachings. They're the cult. Yeah.
They were the cult. And that's when I read about Lenin and his wife, they were really by the book about like communism. Mm-hmm. Like it's communism or the Communist Manifesto was their Bible.
Yeah.
And they were like, well, we can't handle this competition. And we hate competition. Yeah. So
it's sort of our whole thing.
Yeah. Let's get rid of it. That's horrible. So, you learn a lot more about the revolution when reading this book. I love a good history lesson along with it, even though it's a fictional.
Yeah, it's history without being lectured to. Like, it's just, woven into the fabric of the story.
Yeah.
Because this book is not about the history of the time. It's really very much about how characters are adapting to what's going on around them without, cramming history and a bunch of facts down your throat.
But it's nice because it is, as you said, it's a way to kind of like you learn, but you're still on this adventure with like the character. It gives me, and I've mentioned this, I don't know why, multiple times on the podcast, Outlander vibes. Because, you know, I didn't know anything about Scotland.
Yeah, like the Jacobites.
I didn't know. And then I was like, I thought it was made up. But then I looked it up. I'm like, no, it's, they're including real historical things. And then the characters come to, you know, the colonies. And I'm like, wait a second. Am I learning? This is fun.
So our story here revolves around Count Alexander Ilyich Rostov, who is, I've read several things about the book, and everybody calls him an unrepentant aristocrat, which is his crime in this book. The book opens with him at a tribunal where the communist leaders are deciding his fate. Because he's an aristocrat, obviously he deserves to die, you know. But because he has some friends in the Communist Party who respect him because he wrote a poem when he was younger that sounded like it was very favorable towards the revolution, everyone's like, well, you know, sure, he's an aristocrat, but, you know, he did us a good turn, you know, 10 years ago. So, like, let's let him live.
Also, he's very likable.
Yes, he's very charming. He has a
good personality, charming. So I think that's why he was able to be friends with people who had different ideologies than him, and then also, when he was in front of the tribunal, they were like, he's cracking some jokes.
Yeah.
Like
he's making them laugh. And they even they bring that up. They were like, yeah, you know, we know part of your job as of being a gentleman is to be charming and that you're going to use that to your advantage here.
And he's like, absolutely.
Yeah. So he had been living in the metropole for the last 4 years. And so they tell him, okay, this is where you're going to live for the rest of your life. And you ever leave this hotel, you're going to get shot.
Right. But before, just to mention, he was living there because they burned down his family's home.
Yes. Yeah. So his family's estate was in Novgorod and it was burned down.
Yeah. And his family left.
His grandma was the only family he had left. And he came back to Russia. He had been in exile in Paris, which you'll find out in the book. But he came back to Russia to help get her safely out of the country, because as an aristocrat, they would have killed her.
Right.
And didn't care that she was an old lady.
Yeah. So he was staying in the hotel, but he was staying in a nice suite.
Yes.
And when they decided he's going to be a prisoner in this hotel forever, they changed that up. Mm-hmm. They were like, oh, you think you're going to sit in this gorgeous hotel room with all your riches? Like, no. Get rid of all your stuff. Take like two things and I'm going to show you the back house.
Yeah. So he gets moved to like to the sixth floor where the servants used to stay in much, much reduced quarters.
Yeah. It's like cold and rickety and old. And I mean, in the show, they do a good job like showing how. But he's a clever one. He's such a good character. I thought it was a really good.
Yeah. That's what I love. This book is, you know, it almost completely takes place in the hotel. There's a couple of scenes elsewhere, but mostly, you know, whole book over a span of decades happens in the hotel. And, you know, when you were first thinking about that, you're like, man, is that going to get boring? Because most books really rely on different scenes and different settings. But that just shows what a great author Tolles is, because he really makes it about the characters, and their lives and characters and personalities are so rich and entertaining that you don't even notice really that the lack of other places.
But it's also interesting, because he goes a little bit in the past, and then he's also talking to people who get to come in and out of the hotel.
Yeah.
So he has to stay, but he'll get information from others.
Yeah.
And then he also, it's such a controversial moment in history, that a contentious moment in history, that like he can't be bored. Like, how can you be bored? Every day there's something new. You know, one day they are like, everything's fine. The next they're like, wine shouldn't have labels on it because all wine is equal. And this like pisses him off, as it would. But also you see him change throughout the book and the show. When he's first, he's just like this aristocrat that's living there and is like, you know, la-di-da. But then he starts to partake in the hotel mm-hmm. and is a waiter. And then there's a whole bunch of adventures that happen.
Yeah, he really becomes part of the tapestry of the hotel.
And everyone loves him except mm-hmm. one guy who's an asshole and he plays a part in the book.
Yeah. I mean, you got to have the villain.
You have to. Yeah, but no.
I mean, to be fair, the whole backdrop of communism is quite the villain, but
that's true, but he also he grows on people, cuz remember there's a character who's supposed to kind of like keep an eye on him and make sure he's mm-hmm. following the rules, and they raid his room every once in a while, and he's just sitting there like, you're not going to find anything, because he knows where to hide stuff. That guy ends up, they end up becoming friends.
Yeah, but that's not the villain I'm talking about.
No, I'm talking, I know, I'm okay. saying, I'm saying he, in the beginning he was a villain.
Oh, yeah.
Like people who, you know, even his friend Mishka, it was like they had tension, you know, because he was a part of the revolution and his family's. Alexander had to deal with the consequences of that. But in the end, he doesn't cut him off. You know what I mean? Like, he's really good at kind of letting everyone's guard down. And so the only one who really is an enemy is that like concierge/ hotel manager. Yeah. Waiter. He starts as a waiter.
Well, yeah.
What was his problem in the beginning?
Alexander calls him the bishop because like he's just this holier than thou, self-righteous person. And I don't think it ever explains why exactly, but he just hates everything Alexander represents. Like he has such a chip on his shoulder and he just like punishes Alexander over and over and it's like he just can't take what he stands for.
I think that's because now that I think about it, in the beginning of, or at least how the actor plays him in the show, he's this like nerdy, not just nerdy, he's like socially awkward. He doesn't have it going on, especially when you're next to Alexander. And he probably didn't amount much in the previous world. And then the Bolsheviks come and they say, well, all you have to do to be considered, you know, honorable is be a communist. Mm-hmm. And he found like, okay, I'll do that. That's easy. I just need to rat people out and have a stick up my ass. And they were like, yeah, done.
Like boom, power.
Yeah. So I think he found his like meaning in life when he started to be a communist asshole, and and he can hold that over Alexander's head.
Yeah,
but because he's not charming, no one likes him, he's a grumpy puss, like no one.
Yeah, and I feel like everybody has met someone like that just is just an asshole because they can be an asshole, because yeah, like that's where their power is. At this point, the Bolsheviks have actually allowed guests to stay at the hotel once again. So Alexander does have a lot of interaction with hotel guests, because before, you know, the Bolsheviks had taken it over and kicked everybody out and made it pretty much just for party members. But once they realized that they were going to need to let people from the West in and that they wanted them to have a favorable impression of communism and the revolution, they wanted them to think, oh wow, this is something that works, they needed to put on a good face. And so they started to allow people guests back into the metropole, and so ambassadors, business people, journalists, actors, everyone is coming to the metropole, and that's once again the place to be if you are a traveler.
Yeah, they did that on purpose, especially because that's where the, you know, the Bolsheviks, the head people were staying and did business there. They also got the best of the best. Mm-hmm. Like it wasn't a coincidence. Like everyone else was suffering, but you couldn't tell because the restaurant seemed to have food mm-hmm. and everything seemed to be going well. And that's something even mentioned in the book and the movie and the show, is that he's like, well, actually it hasn't been that bad. You know, he kind of is, you know, falling for the illusion of communism because he's stuck in the hotel and there's food and all this stuff. But then he slowly gets word of what's happening outside, and it's like, oh, wait a second. This is a farce. Like, this isn't really what's happening. This isn't communism.
Yeah, it's a really big thing that Stalin tried to keep the famine that he caused by collectivizing the farms a secret. And one of the ways he did that was by making sure that places that foreigners were going to be spending time did not seem like there was a famine. They had bread at every mm-hmm. table for every single meal. Meanwhile, there was no bread or flour to be found in all of the rest of Russia, and people are just starving to death by the thousands.
Yeah. And I mean, also, you in parts of the story there, you know, the chef has to change the menu because, you know, things are not available to them, mm-hmm. or they decide they don't want a dish because it's too fancy or whatever.
Yeah, like in one scene, the manager trades apples for beets because apples are more expensive, and yeah. I think beets are disgusting, so that scene especially affected me.
Yeah,
I was like, dear God, no, please don't trade out the apples for beets.
Yeah, there were a lot of moments like that, and
I know nutritionists would probably be happy with that. Beets were such a superfood there for a while.
So a big part of the plot of the book is that he ends up befriending this like young girl who lives in the hotel, and she kind of is the Eloise of the metropole.
Yeah,
I guess we don't really know about her parents.
Her dad is a Ukrainian bureaucrat, and so he was constantly in meetings and like doing the work of the party, and mm-hmm. she was kind of left with her governess to do whatever she needed to do. I think it's that she was constantly running around the hotel because her governess wouldn't ever take her anywhere. Like, she had the laziest nanny. Oh. And so she had to entertain herself in the hotel.
Yeah. So she just comes up to Alexander and starts asking him questions when he's eating.
Mm-hmm.
And they, I guess, start this like little friendship. And then they go and they explore the hotel together. And it's really cute. And then they find like all these rooms in the back. That's where they kept all his stuff,
mm-hmm.
also. And they're like eavesdropping on communist meetings and stuff like that. And but she ends up, by the way, spoiler alert for this whole book. Anyone wants to know?
I know we're trying so hard not to give spoilers when we do these book club episodes, but it's hard to talk about it.
Yeah, no, there's going to be spoilers,
especially with this big of a book.
Yeah, but it's fun. I love the part where they're like roaming around the hotel, and it's like in a little adventure, and that's where you get the real sense of the hotel, mm-hmm. when they do that. But later on, she gets sent away, right? To school, and then she comes back.
Yeah, her dad sends her to school.
Yeah, and she comes back as like a teenager,
mm-hmm.
and then she's just a little commie.
Yeah, yeah, she's bought the vision without having yet seen the reality.
Yeah, but she gets disillusioned when later on.
Yeah,
and so does his friend Mishka, who in the beginning was like hardcore, you know, I believe in the revolution, and then he gets taken to Siberia,
yep,
and gets beat up and starved and all this stuff, and then he's back, and it's really sad, actually.
Yeah, especially, I mean, the reason that he gets sent to a gulag is just like the punishments these horrible punishments they meted out just for not towing the party line.
Yeah,
like he's doing a translation of Chekhov's letters. And they ask him to leave out the part where Chekhov praises German bread because it's not patriotic to praise another country's bread. And also, Russia's kind of having a famine issue and there is no bread. So they don't want to mention bread in the translation. And he's so offended that they would ask him to do that. And he throws a fit and says, absolutely not. And because he turned them down, they send him to Siberia. Yeah.
But he starts to his disillusionment starts to kind of happen before that, even. because it was the bread thing, but he also was like, they were giving him problems. Mm-hmm. You know, he wasn't always saying yes to them. And he was very idealistic. He wasn't doing it for power. He wasn't doing it. He really believed in.
Yeah, no, he was actually someone who wanted it for the right reasons.
Yeah. And then slowly, you know, because he wasn't a yes man or he saw nuance. Mm-hmm. They were like, nope, you got to go. But his friend Alexander was there for him. No matter what. Like, that's what was interesting about this character. He kind of, he stayed apolitical somewhat, but then it started to get to him. And then what he saw what it did to his friends. Mm-hmm. Even though he's seen what it did to him and his family, it really started to get, even though he was in prison.
Yes.
In the hotel, he was just like, oh, I'll shut my mouth. And then I think Mishka... And then also the girl, Nina, once he sees her come back and once he sees that she's drank the Kool-Aid, I think things start to change in his mind about everything. And it's and he starts to like, oh, and then the memorial for his grandmother. Mm-hmm. And no one showed up because no one wanted to be associated with him. And everyone was just he really you just see these characters like. Their evolution of their beliefs and how, you know, when people start hunting you down, you're like, I don't like you.
I'm not a fan of this. I'm not a fan. So a big part of the book is the restaurant, the Boyarsky. And it has this gorgeous stained glass ceiling that you can see photos of online. And honestly, I really am so impressed that this stained glass ceiling managed to survive.
Wasn't there a part of, I know in the show they wanted to get rid of all the luxe aspects of the hotel and they started painting over that mural.
Yeah, they really did that. And then they managed to restore it later on.
Yeah. As it's happening, he's like, oh, he was repulsed.
Yes. Because some of Russia's greatest artists were commissioned to do the facade and the interior murals for the hotel. So yeah, it would have been a crime against art.
Well, yeah. But you remember in the Grand Budapest Hotel also?
Yes.
And they like, how do you, what's the word? Commu-fied it.
Yeah.
And it's like ugly. And so it they was, tried to do that here. And they also started to put like the Soviet flag everywhere. And then Stalin's face. Oh God. Stalin's face everywhere. I mean, no one wants that.
Yeah.
And then in the office, it was like Stalin and Lenin and, you know, and.
Yeah.
It just became ugly during that time.
I like to see how the hotel and the characters change through time as I know this is about the book, but we did also watch the show because it is really good and it was nice to see it brought to life, but how the fashions changed through the decades was really fun too.
I like that.
Especially because one of the main characters is an actress and so she gets to be very glamorous even for the Soviet Union. You know, she's part of putting a face on the revolution, so she gets to be glamorous when everyone else is probably wearing rags. So it's fun to see her fashions.
Yeah, the scene that she comes in is like her two dogs come and wreak havoc all over the restaurant and she's like, oops.
Yes, her dogs are taunted by the hotel cat, which I love that this hotel has a cat because we love a lobby cat.
Probably to get rid of the mice.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And it's it makes a point that it's a one-eyed cat. So it's not like a fancy, you know, Himalayan or something. It's
a very Soviet cat.
Yes.
That's probably why they didn't put him down. They were like, you worked for the party, didn't you? And the cat's like, meow. Yes, comrade. What I love about the story is he finds extra space where he like, don't you love a good story where they find a secret door or room and then there's a whole other, that's like my dream.
Yes.
Even as a kid, I always wish there would be like a secret attic that I would have access to. Mm-hmm. And that kind of happens with the main character. He's stuck in this little room and then he finds like this extra, like an abandoned apartment.
Yeah, yeah, there's like his wardrobe is up against a door to another room, and so he.
But that it was nailed off. It
yeah,
was,
and yeah. yeah, and so he's able to basically hide this whole secret parlor,
and he restores it with all the stuff they took away from him, because mm-hmm. he finds it with the girl, and then he brings it back, and it becomes like their place and kind of like hiding spot. And also he gets access to the roof. Mm-hmm. And the guy who takes care of that area or something,
he's the beekeeper,
right? And he's just so this book is so random. But that's also fun, where it's like he has this little corner by himself, and I'm sure those places are used for something else now, like actual rooms or something. It's not just like abandoned.
Yeah.
Do hotels even have anything abandoned now? They gotta use every space.
Yeah, I don't know, because it would make sense back then that they used to be servants quarters, and then once servants are no longer allowed, more or less, yeah. that they wouldn't have a use for them. But yeah, you would think they would end up being used for storage or something, laundry, something.
But I would like to believe there's like a secret passageway or a secret room in some of these hotels where, like,
yeah,
you know, the little Eloise get to go and play.
Yes,
and
absolutely. Well, speaking of little Eloise, actually, I wonder if Nina at all was possibly inspired by this famous Russian writer named Lyudmila Petrushevskaya, who in 1938 was actually born in the Metropole Hotel.
Oh, wow.
So she wrote a memoir about her early childhood there called The Girl from the Metropole Hotel. And I feel like she would have been a very Eloise-like character, you know, running around knowing all the secret spaces.
Yeah. I wonder what her parents did. But you think that the author of A Gentleman in Moscow read that book?
I don't know. No. Oh, no, he didn't, actually, because that book came out in 2017 and A Gentleman in Moscow came out in 2016.
Oh, okay. But maybe he met her.
Yeah, but people knew that this was her
maybe
story.
He heard of it and he's like, oh, that's actually really cute. I can add it in. And who knows? Maybe they know each other. Like, we don't know the details.
That's true. He, in his talk that he gave, he said that Nina and Sophia were actually partially inspired by his own daughter, because at the time when he started writing this book, his daughter was 5. And Nina in the book is, I want to say, 8 or 9. And then when Sophia enters the story, Sophia is 5. And so he said that they were inspired quite a bit by his daughter, because he said, until you've had a daughter or experienced a girl of that age, he's like, you don't realize how shrewd girls of that age are. And so that's why Nina and Sophia are both just, you know, whip smart and, you know, can go toe to toe mentally with the Count.
Yeah. Just to keep you informed with the characters, Sophia is Nina's daughter and she comes in later in the book. We won't tell you what happens.
Won't tell you why. Yeah. Just remember that this book takes place over decades. So the characters grow and change and grow up.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, we can't talk about the ending of the book?
No.
Okay. That makes sense.
The ending of the book is very exciting.
It's a great book. And the show is really good too. And like, it really took you into a different world. And it's just so fascinating, because when you watch the show, you really don't realize what's happening.
Yeah.
In the outside world, you just hear it, and you can see how he can't tell either, because he's in this kind of like frozen spot in history where it's just, and especially since they're trying to make everyone believe that they're not going through a famine, they have no issues.
Exactly. So, you know, like, he gets the paper and reads it every single day, but Soviet journalism, quite famous to this day for being censored heavily. So, in fact, during World War II, the Metropole was where a lot of Allied journalists would come and stay to cover news from the Eastern Front. And they actually transformed some of the Metropole's rooms into press offices. But their copy was censored by the Soviet authorities before they could turn it in to their editors. So they would always try to make the stories conform to make like a more heroic angle for the Soviet Union. And there's actually a book about that as well, if you want to learn more about Soviet censorship. A book by Alan Phillips called The Red Hotel, The Untold Story of Stalin's Disinformation War. So even a lot of the information going out to the rest of the world couldn't really tell the story of what's happening inside the country.
Does that also explain that one of the characters, one of the American journalists who Alexander meets after he gets the information mm-hmm. that there's a whole famine going on, and he runs to her and he's like, you need to tell yes. the world about this. And she's like, no, I don't.
Yeah.
Why would she say that? If she's going back to the U.S., unless she wasn't.
Well, she wasn't. She was like, I like living here and I don't want to do anything to get in trouble, basically. So she
had- I mean, yeah, if she's going to stay there, then of yeah. course, but the fact that she didn't feel compelled to go and tell the world yes. that she is not a good journalist.
Not a good journalist.
She should yeah. burn it out.
yeah. Like, she definitely put her journalistic integrity aside.
Yeah. She's like, I have the good life. Not so interested. She probably is also, you know, I don't know what year it was, but.
And she may have been a journalist with communist leanings. And so she yeah. also didn't want to make communism look bad.
Oh, that's true. She probably is also like, nothing's happening in Germany. Like, you don't need to worry about it.
Yeah, exactly. A little bit more history on the Metropole itself is that after World War II, the hotel, of course, continued to cater to international visitors. And some other people that are known for staying there was John Steinbeck and war photographer Robert Capa, and they actually embarked on a tour of the USSR to record ordinary Soviet citizens' lives, resulting in the 1948 travelogue, a Russian journal. So I very much wonder if they were, I have not read this, I wonder if they were chaperoned on this tour to see these quote-unquote ordinary citizens, because this was absolutely during a time when Stalin was still trying to keep everything under wraps about how awful life was. So I wonder who they actually talked to.
Yeah, and I'm sure they were, but I also feel like they probably took some photos of what they thought were cracks in their little story. Mm-hmm. And who knows, their standard of living, I think, was very different than Americans, that they're like, look, they have house.
Yeah.
And Americans are like, okay. Yeah.
Sure. That's a house.
Shack.
Yeah. But so I wonder, I need to look at the photos and read it a little bit. I wonder if they only went to cities like St. Petersburg and Moscow. I'm sure they probably didn't make it to Siberia to explore the gulags. That same year, this is 1948, Golda Meir, the future prime minister of Israel, lived at the Metropole because she was Israel's first ambassador to the Soviet Union. And the Israeli embassy was actually housed in the hotel from June of 1948 until March of 1949.
Wow, that's a nice place to stay.
Right?
Yeah. By the 1950s, with the Cold War beginning to heat up, Stalin welcomed the recently established People's Republic of China into the communist camp. A reception attended by both Stalin and Mao Zedong was held in the Metropole's aptly named Red Hall. Wow. To celebrate the signing of the Sino-Soviet Treaty of Friendship, Alliance, and Mutual Assistance in early 1950. So the communists, we're on the same side.
Following Stalin's death in 1953 and the onset of the Khrushchev thaw, the Metropole settled into a more sedentary existence. So it was renowned, so it continued to serve as the place to stay for foreign travelers, especially movie stars like Marlene Dietrich, who was known to stay there in the 1960s. And then it basically just kind of settles into its Soviet lifestyle for the next few decades. During the late 80s, it underwent extensive restoration, because at this time the Soviet Union is finally realizing we gotta change something or this is all gonna fall apart. So this is when they start opening up to political and economic reforms known as perestroika and glasnost, which was initiated by Mikhail Gorbachev. In 1986 to 1991, the hotel was restored by Finnish companies as part of some bilateral trade happening between the Soviet Union and Finland. And in 1991, the hotel work was completed just in time for Gorbachev's aims to come to nothing and the Soviet Union falls apart. But luckily, that did not seem to impact the hotel too much because it is still open to this day.
Well, I have to say this. The 1970, the time that this hotel was kind of going through its whatever is actually the time many hotels were. So what, the 70s to the 90s? It wasn't a great time for hotels. So the fact that it survived the Soviet Union and those decades, that's not bad.
That's true. Oh, one really interesting fact was, I can't remember exactly which time period this was, somewhere between the 20s and the 60s. Actually, Muscovites were not allowed to be in the hotel for a period of time. It was only for Communist Party members or foreigners, like only international people could stay at the hotel. When the hotel was first built, you know, people who lived in Moscow were used to coming and eating at the restaurant, and it was something that all people in Moscow loved. And then they were banned from coming in for a period of time after the Bolsheviks took over. But because the Bolsheviks wanted to have a little bit of Western trade, they found that the Western governments did not want to use the new currency because they didn't trust it yet. They would only accept hard currency, which was like dollars or straight up gold coins.
Oh, wow.
And so the only way they could get to the hard currency that existed in the country was to let people come into the hotel and stay there and eat, with the stipulation that they could only pay in hard currency. They couldn't use the new Russian money to pay inside the hotel.
About the Benjamins.
Yeah, because all of the Russian nationals also didn't trust the new currency, and so they were like hoarding any hard currency they had to in case they needed it.
But I knew that there was a reason it had to come down to money, because they also want to maintain. How are they going to support their party?
Right.
I mean, stealing, just. But yeah, it's very interesting. This is like, I love learning about this stuff. I want to learn more about the Russian Revolution and how it went down. I mean, I know enough because I know I have family that fled Russia. So it's just, it's rough. So what I know is that my grandmother, who was born in Ukraine, her brother got drafted in the Red Army during the war. No idea. I think he was imprisoned. I don't even know what happened. No one knows what happened to him. And then my grandfather, who's Hungarian, but they settled in Romania after the war, but it was still under the communists. They decided to just kidnap him. For a few months. So this was like the way that my father was really young and he didn't understand. The way he tells me stories, I'm like, as an adult, I realize what they mean. But when I was younger, I'm like, haha, the old country. Haha, that sounds so funny. You have to go in the bathroom in the yard.
Outhouse
in a hole. And you got water from the well. And as an adult, I'm like, holy shit. My dad lived like it was the medieval times. Mm-hmm. It was the 1950s.
Yeah.
But something else is that my grandfather got sent away they didn't know what happened to him. They were like, we're going to, you need to come with us. And it was, they were using him as free labor.
Mm.
And he like built buildings for them because he wanted to be an architect, but he couldn't because he was Jewish and they didn't let Jews graduate or go or whatever.
Yeah.
So he became a carpenter. And they had no idea what happened to him. And then like a month later, he returned.
Oh, my God.
They were like, no, we just needed some labor. And then
That is terrifying.
Yeah. And I'm like, what the fuck? Like, imagine just disappear. Because you know, if you disappear, you don't know what's going to happen.
Yeah.
And I know there's more stories like that. It's just...
Yeah. Oh, yeah. So many people disappear just never to be heard from again.
Yeah. And then I know my great grandmother on my mom's side, they came way before. I think they came right before the Russian Revolution, before communism set in. But that was they were escaping the pogroms.
Yeah.
Yeah. Communism was not fun. The stories I've heard, a lot of fucked up things, like, and just the standard of living was rough. Yeah. I don't think I would survive.
So that was a book club episode. Everybody should join our book club. You can find the link on our website, hotelhistorypodcast.com. And we don't know what we're going to be reading yet, but stay tuned and we'll let everybody know.
If you have a suggestion, you can let us know. Email us, DM us, comment on a post, Morse code, send a fire signal. It doesn't matter. A smoke signal.
Unless you're in LA. Do not light a fire in LA.
Don't do that. No, no. Just send a message in a bottle.
Thanks for listening to Hotel History. You can follow us on most social media platforms, Patreon, and Substack by searching for Hotel History or Hotel History Podcast. If you like what you hear, please leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts and Spotify so we can reach more listeners.